Welcome to the Space Cave. I'm David Huntsberger. If you like this show, you're probably going to like this episode. And I'll be surprised if you don't, because Michelle Lucas is exactly the type of guest I love to have. Someone that's passionate about what they do and likes talking about it, has a fascinating life and history. She studied aerospace engineering, communications and space studies at Purdue and Embry Riddle Aeronautical University. She's done microgravity fluids research. She's trained astronauts. She's worked with the ISS. She started this thing called UNIFY, which is like an agency for astronauts. She has a nonprofit called Higher Orbits. I mean, it just goes on and on. A very fascinating life. And as this comes out today, May 5th, it's National Astronauts Day, which she had a hand in starting. You'll hear all about it and her really fascinating life. So, without any further rambling by me, here's my conversation with Michelle Lucas. From Embry-Riddle, you were the first recipient of the Alumni Entrepreneur Award, which is very cool.
Yeah. And yeah. I'll be honest, it's been hard for me to accept that word, entrepreneur, because to me, I just do things I love. And so sometimes they're a little out of the box, and I guess I created some new things, but I love it, but it's also sometimes hard for me. I'm like, entrepreneur, like I don't build actual things, but everyone's like, no, you are, I swear. And I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Well, yeah, I was kind of telling Shannon, you know, typically when people reach out with potential guests for the show, a lot of times they are like, business types, entrepreneur types who made a lot of money. And I'm not always that interested in that. I'm much more interested in like space and artists. And then when I was reading your bio, I was like, this is incredible. Like all the stuff with the space station. And so I can understand when you say like, I'm a little initially like hesitant toward entrepreneur, because there is an association with that word that means like, you're focused on something that maybe I don't know if I'm focused on that, but
right.
It feels like you were going in a direction where, like, that's the appropriate term.
Yeah. And actually, one of my absolute favorite entrepreneurs who has started a number of space companies, he's the one who's like, no, Shell, you're an entrepreneur. And I'm like, no, like, I just started this little nonprofit. Like, not a big deal. And like, yeah, and you and Annie started Unified Space. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, it's just I love space. And so I can't imagine doing anything else. And so I'm grateful for the opportunity to get to chat with you. I've listened to some bits and pieces of different podcasts of yours with some various scientists and whatnot. And I love that you have these conversations. And so I'm grateful for the opportunity. And may I ask what part of the planet you are actually on in?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles, California, on the western side of the United States. And yourself?
Yeah. I'm never home. I live in Denver. I actually just landed in Florida about an hour and a half ago I've got work here. So that's why I have a very boring, one day, like I'll have to send you, like my office looks like space exploded everywhere and blue in space and all the things. So I'm always bummed when everybody gets to see like a boring, you know, hotel curtain behind me. But right now I'm in Orlando here for Embry-Riddle's graduation on Monday. I've got a couple of students graduating and then the Starliner launch on Monday night.
Very cool. Yeah, I am interested in seeing the office because I, you know, when they like in movies or something, they'll create a character and then that says a lot about them, but it really is. Yeah. My father or, you know, my grandfather was a tinkerer. And it's always like an eccentric older and usually a man. And so I like that, like, to me, this is a big part of the last statement is you believe in collaboration in space and STEM is the key to stars. Space inspires. And I feel like that really captures how I feel about this show as well. And I think going back to like science and podcasting in the beginning, I felt very much like getting access to scientists and especially space people, astronauts, rocket scientists, was almost like they're too busy. They're always just like doing math problems and giving conferences and speeches, not giving conferences, but giving a speech at a conference. And so to get access to that. And then the other day I got forwarded this application to a podcast festival. And one of the categories was like a science category. So there are so many of them now. I love that. I thought, oh, that's great. Like more people are getting access to this. More people are getting exposed to these things. And yet still, I feel like astronauts, maybe not the most well represented, at least for me. It's hard. It's a hard group to get to. So this is exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, glad to be here. And I'll see what I can do to connect you with some astronauts.
Oh, thanks.
You
know,
we'll get you an astronaut in the future if you'd like one.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that'd be so exciting.
Of course.
I do a sketch comedy series, and one of the sketches was kind of about these astronauts, and it's satirical, but they're determining whether to do a heroic return mission where they've lost some, you know, capabilities, and or one of them's kind of selling them on the idea of like, what if we just wrote it out? What if we just see what's out here? And the idea, and maybe this is too negative, but they're kind of pitching like, when you go back and you are an astronaut, your life after that is just going out and like waving at the seventh inning stretch of baseball games and like telling the same story over and over. And I think that's so sad. I think that's where I wrote that from, is like when astronauts come back, their existence is kind of like, hello, but it's not like they're set. It's not like we, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but a lot of times I have to get like regular jobs again, which
right.
is crazy.
Well,
to me.
Exactly. And so that actually is, you know, it that's part of what Unified Space Agency was born out of, was like, look, these astronauts, they go to space. Most of them would do it for free. I mean, I would go tomorrow for free if, you know, if they offered me the opportunity. But they come back, and yes, they do have to either go get a regular job, which honestly, some of them love to do because they love to go further things. So Danny Olivas is working with Collins on the next generation of spacesuit. Jack Fisher worked on the IM-1 landing, the Odie. And so some of them want to go continue to do work. But the other side of people are like, oh, like astronauts, they should fly and talk to Susie's kindergarten class in Piedmont, North Dakota, and they should just do it. It's like, yeah, that doesn't pay the bills. And like, they didn't make that much money as astronauts. So like being able to gracefully navigate that. And given that they are dear friends, many of them are dear friends of mine. And my business partner, Annie, has done music talent management for ages. We kind of married those two. And that was how Unify Space Agency was born. So, like, none of this is part of the path that I planned. So,
well, your path that you did have planned. I mean, it seems like to read your bio, you had a very specific, like, I want to get involved, at least in this world. And then maybe that's how things go just in life. You never know exactly how they're going to go. But, like, I almost have to, like, break it up sentence by sentence because it is so many things. But, like, the International Space Station definitely stands out, but like microgravity fluids research on an aircraft. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that it just feels like you've done things that I don't know. I feel like everyone in life maybe finds a way where they're like, man, I'm doing stuff, but it's not really going. And it feels like when you kind of set your mind to stuff, it really ends up going somewhere pretty cool.
So it's, you know, it's interesting. I thought I had this path of what exactly my plan was. Admittedly, I fell in love with space as a very, very small child on the south side of Chicago, which surprised the heck out of everybody. people weren't talking about space. Most people weren't going to any post-high school education, certainly weren't talking about going to college to go work at NASA. But I fell in love with it. And I was fortunate that I have a mom who is the most amazing cheerleader on the planet, who was like, I don't have any idea how we make any of this work, but we'll figure it out together. And so she took me to the library, you know, begged the librarian, oh my God, my daughter's read every space book you have 12 times. Can you please get some more? We'd go to bookstores. I still have books from 40 years ago that we got on clearance because nobody else wanted the space books, but I certainly did. That was the best present. We had the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, which had the Henry Crown Space Center. So, you know, along all those pathways, I kind of thought I had a plan. I didn't fully understand at first. I was the first in my family to go to college. So that was a whole new can of worms, right? Like, how do you navigate that? I decided to go study engineering. I didn't know what engineering was. My brother told people I was going to drive trains. It does not help that I went to Purdue University, where it is a giant Boilermaker as a mascot. That's, you know, that was what an engineer meant. But I really did think I had this path that I was going to go work at NASA, and I wanted to be an astronaut. And so I was going to go. I didn't know exactly what it looked like other than I was going to work at NASA, and then I was going to apply to be an astronaut and all the things. And then something happened, and with my nonprofit, I very much share this story with students because I think it's important for them to understand that things don't always go quite as you planned. I ended up with kidney stones about 3 years into my career at NASA. And unbeknownst to me, kidney stones are a permanent disqualifier if you have kidney stones before applying to become an astronaut. So when your body gets into space, it's either really smart or really dumb, depending on how you want to look at it. Sitting here on Earth, our bones, our muscles, everything's working really hard. But when you get into space, obviously it's not. And so your body starts to shed calcium right away. Your bones become more brittle. Most astronauts, you know, start to become early osteoporotic. We do have some countermeasures that are balancing those. But when you have 18,000 people apply for 8 slots, you can rule out people who have something like kidney stones, which it's a calcium, you know, calcium is a large component of kidney stones. By the way, if you're allergic to bees, you also can't be an astronaut, which sounds ridiculous. But again, 18,000 people, you pick 8, you know, we can call the, you know, call the numbers there. And so I was really devastated at the time because that was like my whole of my being. That was what I wanted.
Yeah, to do. I was gonna say it's like a movie when a character. I mean, to see little you. Like we just rewatched Up a while ago, and the little girl, yeah. You know, like she's running around with like a homemade cardboard spaceship and the hat and the wants to be an adventurer. But when you can tell when a kid is like, this is my thing, and then you pursued it. I mean, a lot of people look back and go, oh yeah, weird. I remember that. And now I'm this. I'm so far from it. And I don't know which is a worse feeling to be like, oh yeah, I feel bad. I never pursued that. Or to like pursue it as far as you can and then get told you can't go past this next checkpoint because of the kidney stones.
And so I tell kids all the time, I'm like, you know, the cartoons, and I know they don't actually have comics or cartoons that they look at anymore, but at least in my era, it's like the girl, when she was sad, she's always eating a carton of ice cream. Right. And I said, well, I don't love ice cream, but I probably ate more pizza, donuts and cupcakes in a month's time than any human should probably consume in a month. I mean, and consume in a year, in a lifetime. And, I said, but then I realized that, I was in an industry that was where I always wanted to be. And I was doing amazing things. At that time, I had just transitioned into being an astronaut instructor from working in mission control. I was getting to crawl around the space shuttle. I mean, things that little Michelle could never have actually believed would happen. I mean, you know, as a kid, you believe, yeah, I can do these big, grandiose dreams. But if you ever were actually pushed on it, you'd probably go, well, I don't know. Like, I think I can do it. But like, is that really realistic? And so here's the little girl from the south side of Chicago whose idea of a vacation when I was a kid was for us to drive an hour and 15 minutes to Six Flags Great America because they had the Twicket. So if you bought one day, you got the second day for free. And there was a Howard Johnson around the way that was fairly inexpensive, had an indoor-outdoor pool. So that was our idea of a vacation. That was what was in our wheelhouse. And then now, though I'm being told, no, I can't be an astronaut because of kidney stones. Let's also be clear, there are way more qualified people out there technically as well. So it's not like it would have been a given, but like, you know, anyway. But there I am. I'm traveling to Russia, Germany, and Japan for work. You know, I'm traveling to Florida to crawl around literally in the space shuttle. And so I was like, okay, wait a minute, hold on, like reset here. Yeah, it sucks. I really want to be an astronaut still, but like all these other things are so amazing. And I will tell you that in the 20 plus years since that happened, you know, things have changed. 20 some odd years ago, it was only NASA. And then obviously European Space Agency and Roscosmos and Japanese Space Agency sending people to space, but that's changing. And some people who are a little more cynical will be like, well, yeah, now if you're rich, okay, fine. Air travel also started out for the rich. And it used to be that in a classroom of students, my first airplane flight, I was a sophomore in high school. It was also my mother's first airplane flight. Now, when I ask a classroom of students who are freshmen, sophomores, juniors, almost all of them, even in lower socioeconomic areas, have been on an airplane. So, you know, sometimes it starts off as like this really novel, expensive thing and then changes.
Yeah.
So I tell kids all the time, so we haven't flown in space yet, but like I haven't given up hope.
I just hearing you talk about it, like made me feel weirdly more connected in that I know you and think of a room of people when a thing is successful and everyone cheers, everyone jumps up. I never really made that association that like a lot of them maybe were in a position like I want to be on that vessel and I'm not. So now I'm here behind this desk doing this, but I feel connected because I helped.
Yes.
And then the network, like the fabric of it really extends a long way. And I do feel weirdly like, oh man, I would hope she'd let me know if like you're in the oh, cool.
You gave me the goosebumps, really.
Oh, great. It's the coolest. I love team sports. I love people working together. I think it's the best thing humanity can do. And space really represents that in such a cool way because it's the – if you lose a game, it's just a game. But there's so many variables in space that are really, really dangerous and high risk.
Yep.
And so when people navigate those successfully, it's just the coolest.
Well, and space is the ultimate team sport, right? People say all the time, I shouldn't say people say all the time. People have said, no one goes to space alone. Even when Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom and John Glenn flew to space, they weren't alone because there were thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people behind the scenes who helped make it happen. And, you know, on the ground from a space perspective, you know, I would say probably about half the people in the industry are like, heck yeah. Sign me up, put me on the rocket tomorrow, let's go. But the other half actually have zero interest. They're like, no, I like rockets, they're cool, I'm happy to sit here and wait. And so, you know, it really does take everybody. And one of the things that I think is a really important message for, especially, well, for students, is there is a place in space for them. People used to think that the only jobs in space, and I'll be honest, when I was trying to figure out how in the world do I go work in the space industry, I looked at it and I thought there were two paths, because at the time that was what was obvious, was there was the military path. And I thought I wanted to pursue that for a little while and kind of started to go down that path. And then Desert Shield happened and I didn't know how to wrap my brain around that. I didn't know very many people in the military. Actually, I didn't know anybody in the military to talk to about what that meant. So I kind of was like, okay, maybe I don't want to do the military route or being an engineer. And students think being an engineer is one very specific thing. And the reality is being an engineer can encompass so many different things. But also we need artists. We need communicators. We need pure scientists. Blue Origin had a job posting out for astronaut experience coordinator. So at the end of the day, you want to be a travel agent for space. Okay, maybe that's, you know, making it a little too pithy, but that's kind of where things are going. There is a place, if you love space, there is a place in space for you. And that didn't used to necessarily be the case 10, 20, 25 years ago. And so it's really exciting to me to see how things are evolving.
I love too that you're...
I'm sorry, because I just like started rambling with you, Dave. I hope that this is all okay. Like you're like, oh, we're just going to hit go and Michelle's going to start talking.
Let's
Welcome
start
to
over.
My crazy.
No, this is what I like. I mean, I think that originally getting into these sort of podcasts or these talks, like I always loved you're on a layover somewhere and you pull into like a countertop or you're standing charging your phone and someone like you just starts shooting the breeze and you're like, that was great. Like I wish I had more. A lot of conversations in life are like the weather and it's food. Where do you want to eat? And then someone knows a lot of stuff and is passionate about something and they, you know, just have a little bit of time to share it. To me, that I need that. I think it's so vital. So I really wouldn't want to be like, next question. No.
But I can get on track. I promise. Like, you know.
No, this is great.
It's funny. Some people slap my hand. They're like, I can't believe you're going to say what I'm about to say. And I'm like, whatever. I say it in front of them all the time. I am trainable. Astronauts, sometimes it's debatable how trainable they are. And I always used to joke that people like, what's it like to train astronauts? Because I was a technical astronaut instructor for about 8 years. I'm like, well, you know, it's a little bit like herding cats. They're also very food motivated. So, you know, like that's always a good option. And astronaut Jim Riley, who flew several flights, spacewalker, and then was the head of the USGS for a bit, he said to me, hey, Shell, like, we gotta have a conversation. I'm like, okay, JR, what's up? And he's like, you know, that whole astronauts, like, it's like herding cats. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm waiting for him to be annoyed that I've said this, because I'm unashamed about it, right? These people have become my friends. I will openly give them grief about, yes, y'all can be like herding cats. He's like, well, no. He goes, my daughter just got a cat. And I'm like, okay, JR, where are you going with this? Like, the cat's slightly trainable. We're really not. I think maybe you should say, like, herding flies. Have you tried to herd flies? Like, oh my gosh, that's epic. But you know, I've been fortunate. I've had some crazy paths in life. And so I guess I go back to that statement I was making before. If I thought I had this path and it didn't turn out the way I planned, but the beauty of it is that it actually turned out so much more amazing than I could have thought. Don't get me wrong, I still want to go to space. Maybe that'll be like the sprinkles on top of all the amazing that I've had the privilege of being part of. But I think sometimes that's the beauty in life, is you end up with these curveballs and hard lefts when you thought you were taking a right. And sometimes you just have to lean into that turn and see where it goes. And, you know, I certainly never anticipated starting my own nonprofit. I certainly never intended to start and co-manage an astronaut management company. But, oh my God, I'm having a blast doing all of it. And so as I travel around the world like a crazy person, people ask where I live, and my answer is United Airplanes and hotel rooms. People are often like, how do you do it? Like, aren't you tired? Like, how do you do this? I'm like, because I love it. And at the end of the day, if I didn't love it, I couldn't do it. But I love it so much that, I mean, space is just in my blood. And that's why the phrase Space Inspires became immediately, when I was trying to figure out what to call the company, my nonprofit, which is Higher Orbits, and the logoing and the branding and all of that, which, by the way, it's all my favorite things. It's blue and stars. I mean, like, you know, you looked at my closet and you'd be like, oh yes, this is Michelle. The one thing that was very easy for me to know was that it was Space Inspires, because space inspires people, whether you're 2 or 92. And little kids, there are two things they love. And I start just about every keynote I've given over the last decade of, there are two things kids get excited about: space and dinosaurs. I don't know a lot about dinosaurs. I know Sue the T-Rex at the Field Museum in Chicago is amazing. And if you have not seen them, go see them.
Oh, yeah. The Twitter book behind that,
also
too.
Hilarious.
Do you know the whole story behind that? It's crazy.
Like, yeah.
Sue Hendrickson, the way she found her. Oh, amazing. Like, one of the most interesting people in that whole story. Yeah, great. I would love to see. I think I've seen a replica at O'Hare, right? They have like a replica of Sue.
So they've got the big I'm dino ignorant. So there's a big dinosaur. We'll go with there's a big dinosaur at O'Hare. Yeah. But if you get to Chicago, definitely the Field Museum, they actually just did a new exhibit with Sue. They kind of revamped it about 5 years ago, and I hate to say they've Disneyfied it, as I'm at Disney, but I mean that in the best way. They've made it, as opposed to just walk up and you see Sue. Now it's, you walk up and there's this experience that you experience Sue.
Nice.
And their Twitter handle is hysterical, or X, or whatever it's called this week. Whoever's running that Twitter handle, it's pure gold.
Nice.
They start fights with aquariums. they've had Dungeons and Dragons tournaments on Twitter. It's great.
So, cool.
Anyway, kids get excited about space and dinosaurs. But my grandfather, who was not an educated man, a brilliant human in the school of real life and all of that, but hadn't ever gone to college, he loved space. And one of the best things was when we got him a computer at one point and he got online. Honestly, my grandfather was downloading music before I knew how to do that. I was afraid that like there was going to be somebody knocking on his door that he'd done at the, like, you know, Napster or whatever. But he would call me and he'd be like, hey, honey, did you hear about this mission? That there's like a mission that's going to touch the sun. What's going on with that? Like, tell me about it. I mean, in his 90s. And so I think there's something beautiful about space that can inspire all of us, whether it's to, you know, dream bigger, I don't know, maybe take care of our planet a little bit better. You know, you see Earth from that view. Not that I've had the privilege of doing that myself, but from hearing about it from others, it gives you an idea of just how small we are in this universe.
Yeah, I mean, even just seeing a JPEG of it, you're like, that's pretty nuts. I mean, that's pretty wild to be existing and in this perfect little Goldilocks sort of thing that smells nice to us. The air feels nice. It has all the resources we need. The sun feels just at the right distance. It's and to want to go explore and see beyond that. I get a little like, oh, well, we can't. Can we leave this solar system? Our human bodies, like, we're going to have to figure something out to go really far out there. But going back to when you were talking about, like, the military, I guess I had that kidney stone thing where, like, I really thought about maybe doing, like, the Air Force. Flying jets would be very cool, but I'm colorblind. So that was the same thing. Like, can't do it. And then I didn't have the same level of dedication to, like, I'm going to find a way. And I've talked with a lot of comedian friends since the pandemic about that notion of, like, I don't know what to do. You know, you read a biography, their hat factory burned down, comma, so they went and started this other factory. And there's so much emotion in the comma. It's eating all the ice cream. It's eating all the donuts and everything else to just process, what do I do now? And then you move on from that comma and do the next thing. And I would always tell my comedian friends, like, you cannot quit something you love. It's the cheesiest, corniest thing. You'll crumple something up and throw it in the trash. But if you love it, you'll grab it out of there and work on it again. Yep. And you have just found ways to, like, stay a part of it. And as space becomes maybe more accessible, maybe more attainable for anybody, would this be good or bad, I guess I would ask you, in that if you have small kids now, they'll say, hey, you never know. They could have a job in space. Could space become not necessarily boring, but kind of routine, or like, oh, I'm refilling tankers up on the moon for Blanches that go off to Mars?
Like The Expanse.
Like, it's just like my out of college job. I can't see anything up there. It's dark. I'm bouncing everywhere. I'm sick of that. But yeah, it pays okay. And then I'll go back to Earth and I'll do something. Like, could it become that? And wouldn't that be good or bad?
I think it's a great question, Dave. And I think we're a ways from that. But I would also challenge that space has become more commonplace than it used to be. And the public gets very bored quickly and easily. Let's even go back to the Apollo days, right? So in 1961, John F. Kennedy said, we're going to go to the moon before the end of this decade. I mean, we hadn't even spent a whole day in space. He's like, yeah, we're going to the moon. And it's like, yay. And so we obviously flew the Mercury and Gemini flights and then Apollo. And so when Apollo landed on the moon in 1969, there it was actually supposed to be a total of, we should have had three more flights to the moon with Apollo than we did. And the public was bored. Like, they were no longer broadcasting it on television. It no longer had the big rah-rah support that the moon landing did and the subsequent handful of missions. And so they scrapped the last three launches to the moon. The space shuttle, the early days, every single one of them was on television, and then it lost its luster. For people like me, it never lost its luster. But from a public perception, like, oh, it's another space shuttle. Right now, we're in the middle of a really beautiful time that we're doing some exceptional things. Artemis is working to take humans back to the moon. I kind of struggle with back to the moon. I mean, we have not had humans on the moon since 1972. So back to sounds like we were there last week. It's been a hot minute. We had a constant human presence in space with the International Space Station. We're looking at commercial space stations. Boeing Starliner will hopefully fly on Monday night. SpaceX's Dragon has been carrying crews to the International Space Station and private crews. And so it is already becoming a little more common, if you will. I will tell you that it is rare to see a rocket launch on TV. Thank goodness for the internet, social media, all the things. Now I can watch a rocket launch from anywhere. I have been known to be at a winery in Australia and be like, no, hold on. Watch a rocket launch. So it is already becoming more commonplace. I think the challenge becomes that we as a society have to remember that there is still danger in it. I don't want us to get so risk averse that we get ridiculous about things, because everyone who gets on a rocket as a career professional astronaut, and I am going to make that distinction, understands there are risks. And I was at NASA when Columbia happened, and it was devastating. And it is something that still, you know, guts me to my core every day that I think about it, and every day that I'm at KSC. But every one of those astronauts knows what the risks are. And as we move to go to the moon, to Mars, we need to keep in that context that is true exploration, right? These are things that we haven't done. We can't take it lightly. This is not, hey, I'm popping up into space for you know, 3 minutes or 3 days. This is a trek. This is maybe, you know, it's hiking Everest as an analogy. But we are going to get to a point where it is more common for people to be spending time in space. And I think it becomes those baby steps of like, we've had a constant human presence in space. I'll also tell you, I'm amazed how many people don't know that there are people that have, you know, but anyway, so I don't know. There's a piece of me that's like, I kind of like to see what society is like when people are like, oh yeah, you know, just like I was like, oh, I hopped on a plane for Florida. Yeah, I'm hopping on a plane for the space station this weekend. You know, I just needed to get away. My back hurt, so I thought some microgravity would be really awesome. So I think it's possible that can happen. I think it's not going to happen for your kids. It's probably not even going to happen for their kids. I think, you know, we're talking a couple generations, but in theory, yeah. I will say I don't love the, oh, we have to go settle the moon or Mars because we're destroying this planet. No. Hey, how about we take care of this damn planet? And then let's go visit these places. But if we don't take better care of this planet, all we're going to do is destroy the moon or Mars or wherever else we go. And so let's not bring our problems there. Let's yeah. do better all around.
Absolutely. Yeah. Amen to that. Your experience with the ISS is,
yeah.
I mean, I feel like when they told you no, and politely, hey, kidney stones, no, you kind of went like, what if I knew every single other element and component? What if I just learned this whole system from every angle? And so not only like training astronauts, I mean, I want to get back to that too, that like, I think of astronauts as like, yes, well, we have a double redundant two-fault system here and like very like practical and methodical. I don't picture them like, are we eating these Skittles? Oh, we're over there. Sorry. I just don't picture them that way. And then the space station.
Also great terminology, Dave. You did really well.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I was at a party once where I leaned against a stove. And then all these rocket scientists were like, someone smells something? I'm like, nah, I don't smell anything. And then rocket scientists had to come over, oop, you leaned against the burner there, buddy. And then they burned away the gas. And they kept using that like two-fault redundant term and things like that when discussing like parking a car. So it was like very dry. I was like, yeah, this seems like astronauts. So that correlation to me is interesting. But the space station, working with all these other, you know, here on this planet, everyone's angry about this, and they're, yeah, it's political, it's divided, it's small. It's very regional, it's small, and it's my hat and your hat, my flag, your flag, my bumper sticker, your bumper sticker. And then you would think, like, well, in that country, they're our enemy. And then up above us, you're like, hey, guys, we all got to work together. And is it civil? Is it polite? Is it sort of like, this is very different than what's happening down there in that small little planet.
So I will tell you that one of the beautiful things about spaceflight, and again, while I've not had the privilege of experiencing it myself, I've gotten to, you know, one removed, I've gotten to experience it through hundreds of people. And the common theme from all of them, and there's a gentleman that's named Frank White who coined a term called the overview effect, is powerful. The idea that when you get up above the Earth and you see how small our planet is in the scheme of the world, how thin our atmosphere is. And if you think about the Apollo astronauts who left this orbit and, you know, you start flying and you can put your thumb over what, you know, the size of the Earth is, and that's everything you've ever known. it gives you a different appreciation for our planet, and you don't see borders. You don't see, which, okay, technically you don't see borders. I will say that there are ways you see borders based on lights. Like if you look at North and South Korea, there's definitely, you can definitely tell where the border would be because of the light structure. Mm-hmm. But you don't see the lines that we draw on a map. You don't see the differences. You just see one planet. Astronaut Nicole Stott uses the term crew, not passengers, meaning we are all crew members of Spaceship Earth. We are not along for the ride. We all have to work to make this planet a better place. And that means also finding ways for us to all live in peace and harmony. Now, that said, that's obviously easier said than done in certain aspects. The space station has been actually nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, has not received it. I wish it would. I think it's a beautiful beacon for there are 15 countries who participate in the International Space Station and do so fairly anti-politically in space. And I don't, maybe that's not the right word, but in space, when you have Russians and Americans and European and Japanese astronauts all flying together, like, they're just there to do their job. They're there to, you know, to live in space, to do science, to do research, to do these things. You know, here on the ground, yeah, like, if I said space wasn't political, that would be a total lie, because let's face it, NASA's budget is determined by politics.
Yeah.
So anybody who says space doesn't have politics is full of it, because it's literally financially based in politics. But I had some really... So I made my first trip to Russia in 2002 to go to Star City, which is where the training happens for Russian cosmonauts. And I also went to their control center in just outside of Moscow. And it was really fascinating to me, because growing up, Star City hadn't been on a map because it was secret enough. And my dad was very freaked out about me going to Russia, because the Russians were not, you know, they were not the good guys. I mean, obviously I also grew up with it being the Soviet Union in my early days. And yet I get there, and though I haven't gotten to see the Earth from above, I got to work with people from different countries and realize, like, we're all in this for the same reason. Like, we all love space. We all love space exploration. We all want to make our planet a better place. And so I feel fortunate that I have, by being part of this industry, have gotten to see the power of collaboration across borders, across countries. And so I think that's one of the things that space can bring for us. I also am not so Susie Sunshine that I don't understand that there are challenges in certain other aspects. And so it becomes a navigation thing of how do you navigate all the things. But we'll tell you, the astronauts on board the space station, their crew, their family. Plug for something that I get nothing out of, but I will tell you, if there's this amazing experience. It's been in Denver. Actually, it leaves tomorrow. It leaves on National Astronaut Day from Denver.
All right.
It's called The Infinite. And there's a company called Felix and Paul that is a film company out of Canada that did this amazing experience that is the largest walk around VR experience in the world of the space station. And you see the crew on board, and like, you pop into these vignettes of like the crew having dinner. And I bring that one up specifically because the crew having dinner, there are like four or five nationalities represented. And it's just like your family or mine sitting around the dinner table, you know, on a Sunday or a holiday. And so it really does become, like family.
That's so cool. I mean, I guess that's the main, I guess I was going to like question that, or just, I would wonder about that, in that you take any group of people virtually anywhere and put them on a lifeboat, they're likely going to figure out that they have a common goal in mind, which is to survive.
Yep.
And the space station isn't that, but it's closer to that than it is to just have like your day-to-day life in anywhere USA, where you can wake up and just be like, you know what, I'm angry at that person, and go make a sign and stand out in front of their business and be mad at them. And then I think of someone you walking by and just patting their head and just being like, bigger stuff out there, friend, and just moving on.
This is not the hill you want to die on, dude.
Because if aliens came and then humans all had to, hey, now we have a common enemy. I mean, that's been perpetuated in movies over and over again, but it seems so true. And I think of the space station as like, I guess little things could arise, because you think of like the bureaucracy in a little local business of like, we use that type of paper. I got to ask corporate. And everything is so challenging. And then you're on the space station, like, are we using your style of thread here on this? But everything's kind of unified, or is there a lot of that?
Oh, but Dave, I laughed because when you have that many countries, there are a lot of things that like you have to get 15 approvals on. And so people often will ask, what time is it on the International Space Station? And so as we're navigating, you know, four time zones in the United States, a bunch in Russia, a bunch in Europe, like how do you navigate that? And so it became that it was Greenwich Mean Time, as, you know, just they operate on GMT, which is, you know, awesome and not awesome, depending on where you're at in the world.
Yeah.
Right. So there is definitely bureaucracy of you know, getting all the approvals and things like that. But I will also say we try and protect the astronauts from a lot of that, right? Like get them up into space, keep them happy. We want them to be able to work effectively. Because here's the other side of it. Even though it's their dream to go live in space, and Don Pettit has openly said, like, there are humans and there are earthlings and there are space people. He's a space person. Like, he would stay in space for the rest of his life. I'm sure, like, if he could bring his family, that would help. But and then there are other astronauts who are like, yeah, I love it, but like, I'm an earth person. I like to feel the wind in my hair. I like to, you know, feel the grass in my feet. But it does, you know, anytime you do anything for a long time, it can become challenging. And so all of our astronauts are living in space for months. Frank Rubio spent over a year in space. And so you can love it. They love it, but it is also a job at some point. And like we all, no matter how much we love our jobs, there are some days where you're like, oh, I just like, I don't want to deal with it today. And so we do try and make sure the astronauts don't have to deal with the bureaucracy quite so much, but on the ground, yeah, 100%.
This is fun to learn about all these little idiot like elements that I just think wouldn't really, when people think about space, when they think about astronauts, they don't think about these little parts, you know, like no. You see a movie and you're like, oh, so that's how they eat or that's how they use the bathroom. Yeah. But the interpersonal stuff is interesting. The way they are trained, the way they have to interact with other astronauts from other areas. That is fascinating.
Well, and here's the thing, Dave, you know, there are approximately, don't quote me on the number. I haven't looked it up exactly. And there's also debate of who gets to fall into this category. So we're going to go within approximate. There are approximately 700 humans who have been to space.
Okay.
Take 700 people from across the world. You're going to get 700 different humans. Now, yes, there are certain characteristics, if you will, that are probably common, pretty driven, right? Like you don't get to be an astronaut when you're, you know, hanging out on the corner on your surfboard all day long, so there are probably some characteristics that are similar, but they're all also very different humans. And so there is a lot of interpersonal elements. And one of the things that I really love that we've been able to do with the International Space Station, even more than the space shuttle, because the space shuttle flew anywhere from 5 to 16 days, whereas the space station, like you're going there to live, right? Like we have to make it so it is a livable thing. We really tried to keep the human in human spaceflight. And so trying to make sure that they have some of the creature comforts of home, space food. Don Thomas is known for saying it's not terrible, but he wouldn't go to a restaurant and pay for it kind of thing, yeah. Right? Like, you know, but we've worked like Sam Cristoforetti, who is an Italian astronaut. There's an espresso machine on the space station now, and they've worked to bring in different foods that are based on where someone is from. You know, food, that is going to be one of our bigger challenges when we go to Mars, and Mars is a 2.5 to 3 year trip, is, you know, food isn't just about sustenance. Like, I'm a foodie. I love food. I am unapologetic about it. Give me all the food. I will plan my trips around where are we going to eat? Where am I getting a donut? Which cupcake place? It becomes a part of community. And it becomes a part of our mental well-being. And so keeping that in mind, as we have astronauts on the space station for a year, trying to make sure that they're having that kind of creature comfort. They get excited when one of the cargo ships show up because it has fresh fruit, fresh tortillas, things like that. And so keeping the human element of spaceflight, and it actually, music is one of those things. We've had a number of musical instruments that were on board the International Space Station. Guitar, most people remember Chris Hadfield playing Space Oddity from space. What most people don't realize is that there's also a keyboard on board. Kjell Lindgren played the bagpipes from space. Like, okay, the bagpipes are really loud. I really want to know what everyone else thought on the space station as that was happening. But because music is another one of those pieces of humanity. And so I think those are great also connect points back to those of us here on Earth who are like, okay, space, but like, what does space have to do with me? Well, they're humans just like you or me that are doing these things. And music is a great connect point, which is also a great connect point to, so National Astronaut Day this year, we decided to marry space and music because there are so many great connect points. It is a big piece of being human. And Annie, my partner with Munify, comes from the music world. And she's like, well, look, if MTV can give a Moon Man award to rock stars, why can't rock stars give, you know, a music award to astronauts? And so for this year's National Astronaut Day, we launched the Astronaut Rockstar Awards. Cool. And we just announced those yesterday. And so there are 5 individuals who are getting the Astronaut Rockstar Awards this year, because space is something that really should unite us all. Maybe not everybody realizes that space touches your everyday life. I love when people are like, I don't need anything to do with space, as they have their phone in their hand. I'm like, really? That's so cute. That's adorable that you think that. Thanks. Okay. But music is something that also unites us. And on the space shuttle, it used to be that there were wake-up songs every day, where the astronauts' families, friends, the flight control team, they would pick songs that were meaningful to that person. And it was how they woke up every day, was with a wake-up song. So human spaceflight.
I like
human
that it
is a very important part.
Yeah, and it makes so much sense to try to like bring the human element in, as opposed to, I think when people think of, oh, you're going to space, go train on Antarctica for a while with nothing, no sensory elements whatsoever, and just get used to that. And then you can go to space. Like, could we try it the other way, where maybe I could have like a stuffed animal that I pet, or a song I like, or food I like? Can I keep some things that I enjoy? No, you're going into like sensory deprivation. Like, that makes no sense. And yet it felt like that was the only option for a long time. It felt like, well, we don't have a lot of room. You're going to have to get used to living without all of these things.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, there's still not quite as many creature comforts as we're used to here. You know, we still don't, like, my dog is a little mess of a cartoon creature, and he's got these floppy ears, and we all always joke, we're like, we'd love to see what Guinness looked like in space with his ears flopping about. So, you know, there are still some creature comforts that we can't do, but we have realized that it is important to take care of the human, because if it's not going to be about human spaceflight, then it can be all robots. But the reality is, robots can't do what humans can do. I forget exactly what the statistic is, but I'm going to ballpark it, and I'm sure somebody can correct me. I'll call Larry James from JPL after this and ask him. But in all the mapping that was done on Mars in like months by a robot, like a human could have done it in days. Mm-hmm. Because you have the ability to very quickly look and go, oh, wait, no, that rock looks really interesting. Wait, let me go that way. Whereas with a robot, you can only teach it to do so many things. So from a scientific and an exploration perspective, human is really important. But like, at the end of the day, I'm a people person kind of thing. And I think that's what connects us to the greater cosmos. And I had somebody ask me last week or a couple weeks ago, she's like, one word answer, you know, are we alone? And I'm like, no. And I think that kind of surprised her at first. Because I don't want to believe that we are the only living entities in all of the universe, right? Like, we are a tiny planet in all the things that exist. And so I think that it's important for us, as we do go explore, to make sure we're remembering that it is special that we are humanity, and keep that as a piece of our space travel.
I love it. I think, and beyond just, you know, keeping humanity in it, you also need humans to come into that. So in sports and team sports, they'll say, oh, this player has something you can't teach, whatever that is, a physical gift or some sort of innate inside thing. But I'm sure your mom was like, this little girl has a thing that I certainly didn't like coerce her into doing. It's just there. So you're kind of lucky, but I'll bet there are a lot of kids like you that let that go somehow, or had it talked out of them. So how do we keep the kids that have that to start with? And how do we, maybe someone's 50-50, kind of compel them that STEM is cool? Dancing and doing goofy videos, maybe all your friends are doing that, and maybe we can make those a little cooler. So, but how is there a way to, like, we need people excited about space and, you know, technology and all the stuff that goes into it. How do we keep that and nourish it and grow it?
Oh, Dave, you're speaking to my heart. You know, I was very lucky that I had someone who continued to nourish that for me. And I'm also a very stubborn human. so when people are like, you can't do that, I was like, whatever. Growing up on the South Side area of Chicago also helps with that grit. But I think it is important that we offer opportunities to students, and especially those who are the non-traditional, non-conventional. That was me. I mean, I look at, so it after I left NASA, I have a consulting company, and I started doing consulting for various space companies. But then I did some educational outreach consulting with an international nonprofit and realized that I really wanted to be able to help students who maybe were like me and had an interest, but didn't have an avenue to pursue that. Obviously, the internet, social media makes it a lot more accessible than it used to be, but it doesn't change the fact that somebody can be completely interested in something, and if they aren't given support, they're not going to stick with it, especially when something is a little more difficult. And I joke all the time. I'm like, parents, please quit saying math is hard. But I'd also be lying if I didn't say that a STEM degree is harder than an underwater basket weaving degree. Well, I don't know. Underwater basket weaving, I'm pretty sure I can't do. But and so we need to put into place opportunities for students to help them stay interested, give them skills, but also show them the opportunities and possibilities that exist. Because a lot of times students still have a myopic view of what, or a tunnel vision view of what it means to be an engineer or a scientist. And they're like, well, I don't want to just sit and code all day. It's like, no. That's like, yes, that is an option. Mm-hmm. But that is one of like a ton of options. And so I started Higher Orbits, which is a 501c3 nonprofit that uses spaceflight to get kids interested in STEM. Going back to the whole entrepreneur thing, I just wanted to do it. I was a kid who wanted to go to space camp, got to go because of a scholarship. But that also meant I had to travel to Alabama, which, you know, was cool and all, but like, I remember my mom looking at the map going, Chicago, Alabama. Now, how do you get from here to there? Like, 'cause that also costs money kind of thing. And so I wanted to bring a space inspired STEM event to the backyards of students who might have interest, and do it in a way that the kid who likes space and STEM like me can help elevate their skills and stay engaged. But I also wanted to try and what's the proper word? Social engineer students who maybe didn't think that it was so cool into realizing, hey, this is really awesome. I compare it to, I hate kale. Do not put kale on a plate in front of me. I will not eat it. If you hide it in my smoothie, you know, maybe it's okay. And so we created a program called Go for Launch, where students get to work with an astronaut for the entire event, and they compete to have their science flown to space. And we break it up in a way that it's like a out of this world science fair. Every kid has done a science project in school in some way. And so how do we take that and make it accessible to the average student, including the student who's like, STEM sucks. Like, I don't want anything to do with it. Oh, I don't know, but I'll hang out with an astronaut for 2 days. How do you show them the pathways and the possibilities? We have a massive shortage of STEM graduates coming out of our universities within the United States. We have a STEM workforce issue. We have to quit going to just the same well. We focus on the kids who are already geeked out, and that's great. There are amazing things for coding. There are amazing things for robotics. I will also tell you, the kid who's already taking those camps and whatnot, they're already geeked. They're already like, they're in.
Yeah.
And I say geeks in a good way, because yeah. I embrace my geekness all day long. I mean, look, it's how do we find the kids who don't know they can do it? And so I think that is our challenge as a society and as individuals. And to me, I'm going to be honest with you, Dave, part of why I love being able to have this conversation with you is I'm a storyteller at heart, and I'm not your traditional engineer. I know that shocks you, but I think there's power in storytelling, and I try and convince everybody to please tell your story, because you never know which piece of your story is going to inspire someone to follow a similar path, to make decisions based on something you said. And that's one of the things that I think is amazing about being able to share the stories of astronauts. And that's part of my goal with Higher Orbits. It's part of our goal with National Astronaut Day with the Unified Space Agency, is every astronaut's journey is different. And that journey is going to resonate differently with every person who hears it. And so the more stories you can hear, the more there might be one that really sticks with you. Of, you know, maybe it's that they grew up where you did. Maybe it's They had a similar family background. Maybe, you know, there's so many touch points. And so I think one of the important things for everybody to do is to tell your story.
I love it. This has been so great. And I love your story. I mean, your story is like a little bit overwhelming in this, if someone were to try to go out and replicate it, because it's so much. And I think it leaves a wake behind it of people inspired, more capable, hopefully more enthusiastic about contributing to something like that. And that to me is a fulfilling life. That feels like something that, as your life goes on, you're like, yeah, I did something that kind of moved the needle or made an impact or a difference a little bit. I mean, I'm not trying to like blow any smoke, but I do feel like when people want that sort of meaning in their life, you got to go do it. And so Higher Orbits, Unify, an agency for former astronauts. I love that. And then where can people tune in and see these awards given out from musicians to the astronauts?
So if you go to www.nationalastronautday.com, we did our big announcement. We're going to have some videos coming out. And the actual awards are going to be awarded in the coming months. OAR is going to present the award to astronaut Jack Fisher on July 20th, which is another, obviously, big deal of a space day. July 20th was the moon landing. May 5th for National Astronaut Day is the day Alan Shepard flew in space. May 5th, 1961 at 9:34 a.m. He became the first American to fly to space. So check out www.nationalastronautday.com to find out all of that. And, you know, maybe come see rock stars giving astronauts awards in person.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I oversold it. If you like the show, I'm guessing you really liked that conversation. Enthusiastic, passionate, excited about what she's doing, and making a big difference in all the things that she does in helping out former astronauts, kids who want to get involved in STEM programs and getting them excited. I just think it's great. And so hopefully I'll be able to take her up on that at some point in the future and have her come back and chat some more, because I really enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. And I couldn't think of another song that fit. Usually don't play songs more than once, but I think this time it's worth making an exception. This song fits a lot about what Michelle was talking about. She was a little kid, and how much of a hero is her mom? I'd love just someone that's like championing this little space kid. Like, come on, you can do it. It's got to be a thrilling feeling to see her now so kind of ensconced in the space world. Anyway, this song, for the second time being played on the show, probably not the last, but it fits this episode so perfectly. It's by Katie Tupin. It's called Astronaut. I hope you like it. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.